This is an audio recording of a presentation by Graham Huon of Huon Labs Melbourne, given to the AES Melbourne section on June 21st, 2010. This work is copyright protected. Unauthorised distribution is prohibited.
Guys, thank you so much for coming. Our very own Graham Huon. Yes, that's away from you, is
that right? That's right, yes, that's fine. Yes. You'll hand over to me?
I think we have to, really.
Okay. Well, you all came out in a brave, a cold night, so that's good. Okay. I just introduced myself. My name's Graham Huon, and I run a very small research and development facility in acoustics here in Melbourne. And we have big eyes for the world, so we spend a lot of time travelling overseas. You should also know that we do work with woofers in our business as well. So, a bit of humour. Tonight I'll be spending quite a bit of time on the behaviour of waves in air. And that's a bit away from the standard electronics and digital processing domains. But I believe this will lead to a better understanding of present-day audio and also will be useful for revelations about the future of audio. The presentation is essentially what I did for the SEMPTE guys in, I think it was July or August last year at the Sydney conference. But I've added some additional material to clarify what I'm talking about. Also, if you can note that there are some copyright and intellectual property restrictions associated with this work because there's a whole stack of patents and I subsidise the world patent industry, I'm sure. Okay, I'm going to go through four things, basically, a bit of a history of sound, not because we just want to spend time looking at sound, but we need to know where it came from and why it's been doing what it has been doing for the last 75 years. Then we'll have a look at the sweet spot. You're all familiar with the sweet spot in audio? I hope you are. That's good. That's good. Then I'll go on to talk about the new formats beyond surround sound, what they mean, how they work, and finally we'll go through a series of production change implications for the future on that, starting from the capture end right through to the render and listening area. The developments that I'll be talking about are not incremental changes. We could continue evolving surround sound, continue making incremental improvements. What I'm talking about tonight isn't that. It is, in fact, a disconnect. The trouble is, it's hidden. And so a lot of people haven't seen that there is a change coming. I'll try and alert you to that tonight, and I hope you'll ask me some questions about how all that fits. There are some restrictions. Tonight we won't be talking about all of the sound components of the direct sound, the earlier reflections, the late reflections, and the reverberant field. We'll basically be talking about aspects where there is some semblance of a spherical wavefront. We can talk about the other aspects also, but it'll take too much time. Tonight we need to focus on the early reflections and the direct sound. Also, we won't be covering low-frequency reproduction. It's a separate topic again, and I've spoken on that before, and I can do it again. We just won't have time. The issues there are, first, that the room modes interfere with the wave propagations, and the second thing is that humans have difficulty resolving direction of low-frequency sounds, and therefore it's a separate topic. Okay, a brief history of sound. One of the issues with this was people don't actually talk about the history in terms of developments that influence multiple business areas. They tend to talk about what happened in cinema, what happened in hearing aids, what happened in audio. What I'm going to do now is try and pull together those threads and see what the common links were. The first thing was, for thousands of years, we had sound reproduction. We had town criers, we had orators, and every one of those, in their times, years and years and years ago, tried to improve the fidelity. They used what was available. They used cupped hands. and they used shouting, and they used the techniques that they had, but there was always a quest to improve sound reproduction. In 1857, Leon Scott de Martinville made an apparatus to record scratchings on glass plates in smoke. These scratchings were voice recordings. It's interesting to note that these recordings were done in 1857, but that they were only just reproduced in 2008. And that website actually has the reproduction of these sound signals from 1857 on it. And it's worth having a listen, particularly as some of them are the voice of the inventor.
Could you read out the website?
Yes, certainly. The website is www.firstsounds.org/sounds/scott.php. In 1857, the first acoustic recording occurred. We couldn't play it back. 20 years later, Edison and Bell both moved on from there, one of them into the acoustic domain for the gramophone recording apparatus, and the other one into the electrical domain with the telephone. Quite a lot of work was done in the 1800s to distribute sound in the electrical domain. These were basically telephone sets, and they were popular, I believe. I wasn't there. They were popular at the time because they enabled even stereophonic sound to be distributed out to people who were prepared to hold the earpieces to their ears. The microphone was necessary for that, and so it was developed, and magnetic recording was quite early. It was before electronics and amplifying devices, but it was crude. The optical track for the cinema was also on that same sort of time frame. The electronic era really heralded the massive development. Broadcast, radio, television, amplifying devices, recording, a whole lot of technologies were enabled by that. The first work in that for the amplifying device was 1903, but it was really about 20 years later that those technologies began going into commercialisation. And by the 1920s, a lot of things were starting to come to pass. Now we get into where I want to take you tonight. The stereo format was first proposed by Blumlein in 1931. He put in patents on that. The interesting thing about that was it was driven by the cinema. The cinema was having trouble. Television had come along, and they were losing audiences. And they said, can we improve the situation? Can we get something that will give us a better capture of audiences? So Blumlein said, well, I think I can spread the sound across the screen so it seems like the voices are tracking the sound. And I can do that with two microphones instead of one. Stereo format was born. The first problem with this was not really a problem for cinema, and that was that you had to be looking to the front. That was okay because that's where the pictures were. The second problem was there was only one place in the room where it worked effectively. That was right in the middle, where Diego is. So we had the birth of what was to become known as the sweet spot, the place where it all seems to work, and if you're not there, well, I can hear it, but it's not really working. Another aspect which came up almost immediately with the cinema was the problem of having dialogue switching as they changed perspective shots with the vision. And that was causing problems, so a centre speaker was introduced in the cinema and the dialogue was sent to that so you didn't get this chopping and changing as they changed the views. And that actually persists today, but is very much associated with cinema and visual imaging. What then ensued was something approaching 40 years of competitive development. with a series of studios wanting to outdo the other studio and wanting to come up with a new sound, Fanta sound, to come up with a new AO, Todd AO sound reproduction, to come up with all these new techniques to compete. What was missing from that was no attention to standards. It was free-reign competitive development of the next best thing, very proprietary, very commercial, and not managed. In 1951, 20 years later, stereo went into the home with the record. It was a cheap distribution format and it was widely available. The standard room finally came along in 1974, 20 years later, with the ITU 775 standards for surround sound layout. Finally, the problem of the proprietary studios was overcome and the directors could produce sound renders that were consistent in the relatively consistent in the reproduction area. But all along, these developments still preserved the sweet spot, the one place where the sound sounded okay. 20 years later, in 1995, along came DVDs and multi-channel sound was available for the home. So multi-channel media distribution went into place. Again, you could hear the sound and experience the effects throughout the listener area, but there was only one place where you could hear what the producer wanted you to hear, the sweet spot. There is a common thread here, and that is that it appears that we have some change occurring every 20 years. If you go back through that, it's quite interesting to see that occurs. I think the First World War, caused a bit of a hiatus in that. But it's very interesting that every 20 years there seems to be a significant development. Going by those timelines, 2015 should be a very interesting year. What can we do? We've got surround sound. We've got stereo, we've got surround sound. We've got the forward perspective, we've got the sweet spot. What can we do for the future? We could improve the frequency response of the channels. We're at sample rates of 96,000 samples per second, a Nyquist rate of 48 kilohertz bandwidth. I can't hear much above 15K, but 48K would be good. Some people can hear 22, 23K. Can't really improve the frequency response, we could. The bit resolution, which dictates the dynamic range. We're at 140 dB now. I don't think humans can survive 140 dB dynamic range, but we've got it. We really can't do much with the dynamic range. What we can do is use special effects, echo, reverb, touchy-feely stuff, or we could add more channels. I'm as guilty as anybody in this because I did the demonstrations of 10.2 with Tom Holman in America in the year 2000. 10.2 was a 14-channel discrete sound system. It's 14 because it's 10 channels, but we had options for dipole or direct radiator surrounds, and they were selected. Its main claim to fame was it was the first introduction of height channels. Everything else in surround has been in the plane. For the first time, you can see them there, the two forward height channels that are up at 45 degrees up and out. Stereo bass, 0.2. Some more woofers. Okay. That record lasted for about a year. And then NHK came up with their 22.2 discrete channel surround system. Can we add more channels? Can we go beyond 22? There are domestic factors. I mean, the speaker manufacturers and sellers would love you too, but there are domestic factors. So, all of these developments continue with the surround format of the sweet spot and the forward perspective. I think I've made that point. There are some non-surround alternatives, and I would be failing if I didn't mention them. The work that was done on head-related transfer function render, where the ear has a certain, or the head and the ears have a certain acoustic behaviour. You can capture that behaviour and then reproduce it so it behaves as if the sound sources were out in space. That is not strictly surround, but there is still the issue of one single forward perspective with those systems. When you turn, the sound turns with you because you're turning your ears. And that has been done in room, and it has also been done with worn apparatus. We have, Paul, you don't want me to mention the work that, no, he doesn't want me to mention. Paul did a bit of work on this in England. Okay, the second one is work done by a gentleman called Mike Gerzon, who developed a capture device. He was a mathematician. He developed a capture device that captured the wave field in all directions simultaneously and then enabled you to post-extract directional microphone elements out of that. So you just caught the whole lot, and then at a later stage you may say, I'd like a stereo pair, or I'd like a series of microphones in a particular format, and you could still do it. He didn't specify exactly the one loudspeaker format. And so even today, with the ambisonics groups and so forth, they are still tending to use the standard surround formats of loudspeaker placements. And really, they haven't got any other option to do it. So that's about it. That's where we're at. Is there something beyond this? What's coming in the next 20 years? Well, we'll have a look at that now. Let's have a look at this damn sweet spot. The background is what we're hearing is sound waves in air. We almost immediately associate those with the source. But there is an interface between the source and the person, and that's the air. And the waves propagate in that air, but they do it very quickly, 340 metres per second. But there is still an interface. We sample at a microphone, 1 point. We sample at 2 microphones, 2 points. We sample with our ears, 2 points. Each one of those observation points captures just the resultant sound at that point. That's what you hear. All of the contributing sound sources reduce down to one composite wave at the ear. It contains all the different frequencies, has all the different source directions, wave travelling directions and so forth in it, and it will represent correlated sound sources where the two sound sources are doing the same thing, or totally independent sounds, cowbells, foghorns, people talking, etc. The first bit of mathematics is that we can look at defining the pressure and velocity at a point as being the net result of all of those contributions at that point, being what is a vector in the sense that the velocity has direction, but the pressure at the point is a scalar. Using those techniques, we can start to look at behaviours of one source, then two sources in a stereo system, and so on. I'm going to show you tonight what I call wave model snapshots. These are graphs, but they're basically the result of plotting out sound intensity at a series of points. And you can do that any way you like. If you do it consistent with time, you'll get a directional pattern or a directivity pattern. And I'll show you some of those now. We use a whole series of tools to model those sound waves and then to analyse the results and to build systems. Here we have a person listening. You've got to imagine that you're looking down on the sound field and you've taken a two-dimensional slice. We have a sound source in the centre there. It is radiating out a spherical wave. And at an instant of time, the wave has travelled to a certain point and has a certain intensity. Spherical. That's a single source there making the blue wave. If we now replace it with two sources and feed them the same signals, they don't behave the same way. For this person listening here, it's the same intensity. But as the person moves off axis, the path differences to where the person is start to interfere and cancel the waves. And so you'll find in certain directions at certain frequencies you get cancellations and so on. That's an issue. The point I'm making here is that that is a wave snapshot that has been taken to show the velocity and pressure at all of those points around the source and is displayed in a graphical form, which in fact in this particular example is the directivity plot for that frequency for two speakers. Do you understand that concept? Good. You get lobes and nulls. And that's all not magic, it's just the laws of physics. If we now consider live sources, the acoustic wavefront of the listener is all these sound sources that are real, crickets and chirping birds and things, real things. And as we said, vector amplitude and phase at each point. The vector sum will change if you change your observer point. The vector sum will change if you change the location or intensity of any of the sources. So it's going to be dependent upon where the observer is, and it's going to be dependent upon where the sources are. What we want to do is we want to capture all those sound sources for reproduction, and therefore what we want to do is to recreate faithful renditions of those wavefronts that we originally had arriving at us. We need to do that for all sources. We need to do that for all listener locations. And we need to do that for all frequencies. Now we'll have a look at one of those wave snapshots for this. Here we have a spherical wave propagating out from a point into space. A person where their head is would hear that sound coming at them. And that sound could be at any frequency. It's a point source radiating all frequencies equally in all directions. And a person will be able to say, that's there. I know where that is. I know that sound's over there. What they're doing is, they don't actually know that sound's there. What they're doing is they're receiving a wavefront and they're doing two things. The first one is, they're taking into account the curvature or divergence of that wavefront. And the second thing they're doing is picking the normal or the perpendicular to that wavefront. They're the two processes they're doing. And they do that almost instantly so they know where the source is. If I now change the source to move it forward towards the listener and turn it down, it completely changes the wavefront curvature. But the person listening still does the same thing. They still take the normal of that wavefront and they still know what the direction is. So the curvature is being analysed and then the normal of that curvature is being deduced by the brain. If the source is directly ahead, that all works. If the source is moved off to the side, and here, you've got to imagine you're looking down on this, even without turning your head, you know where that source is. What you're now doing is analysing a wave coming from an entirely different direction and doing the same two things, working out the curvature and deducing the normal. So let's now have a look at that approach when we consider a stereo sound source. Two loudspeakers. And what we're going to do is we're going to reproduce the two, give the two loudspeakers the same signal so that the image is in the centre. A standard stereo mono reproduction. The vector waveform analysis of that says that at certain frequencies, this array will start to become directional. It'll start to look like what was happening in the earlier slide where it's got lobes appearing. And at high frequencies, it certainly will. But what we now say is, this person right here doesn't know anything about that. They're not over here. They're at the front, listening there. And they're still saying, the waves have arrived, I can handle the curvature, I can handle the direction it's there. So when you're sitting in the centre, you know that the sweet spot's in the centre. That makes sense? Even when you go to higher frequencies where this array, because it is an array, it's two loudspeakers, each emitting sound. When you go to higher frequencies, this starts to beam. You're not actually seeing all of that. You're still here saying, yeah, it's still in the same direction. Curvature, normal, same direction. So here we have two wavefronts, one with my snapshot, one for the sound source at the centre, the purple rain, plot, and one for the sound source moved off and you're still taking the normal to that curve. All right, now what happens if we do the same thing for a higher frequency where this array is becoming directional? Well, if you get the microscope, well, if you get the magnifying glass out, you'll actually find that the normal to the curve right there is not now straight ahead. It's just curved around the corner a bit. And it is, in fact, pointing at where that source should be. So the vector result is actually still pointing in the direction you want the image to be. What happens now if you move away from the centre axis? If you move off that centre axis? And I should point out that these plots are done with perfect omnidirectional sources. These are not directional speakers, these are perfect omnidirectional sources. What happens now when I move off? Well, if the waves propagated out a bit further by the bottom. If I now move around to here, my brain is going to do exactly what it did in the front. It's going to say, where's the curvature and where's the normal? But now, if I'm here, the normal to that curve is down here. And if I go to another frequency, the normal will be somewhere else and somewhere else and somewhere else. So I just can't assemble a single location source. The sweet spot's stuffed. There's some important things there. One of them is, even with perfect omnidirectional loudspeakers, you have a sweet spot. Another one is, if you move away from that sweet spot, your brain is going to be doing processing over time, trying to sort out all these image locations that are changing the frequency.
Right.
Yes.
The perception of this wavefront curvature, I assume, has been done in your brain by facial agents. Is that right?
Yes, we can use the various models of the hearing.
Right. Along those lines.
ITD, IID models. You will see in a minute that they have trouble.
Right.
That's exactly right. But valid, yes. But what I should say is the human can do this. Microphones are evolving. They're not quite there yet, but they can also do it. So, if we don't have true omnidirectional loudspeakers that radiate uniform spectral energy at all frequencies, things are going to be worse. They won't be better, they'll be worse. And that's what modern loudspeakers are. They have a directional characteristic which gets tighter and tighter and tighter as the frequency goes up. And that's exactly what I'm saying there. One of the items that does occur is if you move around in a room with a stereo system, you'll get closer to one or more of the speakers. And that will give you a proximity effect. You'll hear that lock to it and then fill in the rest of it. With more channels, there's more of that going on. But there is still a single location where it all works. Even so, a lot of manufacturers have had a go at making omnidirectional loudspeakers. And there are a few examples here. Quad electrostatics, the name tweeters, Bang & Olufsen's diffractive arrays, and something that's quite amazing. Even if they perfected those, they still would have a sweet spot. Okay, so 30 seconds pause. Questions? You knew it all? There's some stuff there that's a new perspective, I hope. Yeah?
Perhaps just confusing you a little bit as well. It's just they said that the normal, I mean, you just do have curvatures, so could I guess distance as well? Or was just able to find the normal?
You've been to one of these presentations before. No, it's very perceptive. What's happening here is curvature is dictating distance. Very perceptive. If you haven't been to the lecture, it's very perceptive. Yes, that's true. The curvature is containing information about distance. But you're going to need an apparatus that spans part of the curvature, like the ears, which is separated.
Can you even do it?
Yes. Yes, you'll see that in a minute. Okay, so the new formats. We've talked about surround, we've talked about head-related transfer, we've talked about Gerson, we've talked about a lot of things that have been happening. We now go on to the new formats. What the hell are they? Well, you're about to find out. The waves in air, we talked about. If we wanted to recreate the sound field in this room that was a replica of the sound field from a series of discrete sources placed in that room, we should then be able to hear exactly what we heard in the original with the original sources. Fine. But that should also work if you move, because that sound source is going to stay where it was. And you'll get a sensation of a moving perspective of a fixed object. Moving because you're moving. So if we can accurately recreate these curved wavefronts, we can actually place sound sources in space at a distance in a direction and actually have them stay there as we move. Do you know what that means? What about the sweet spot? It's gone. So the answer to the sweet spot now becomes the ability to recreate controlled curvature wavefronts. Here's an example of a wavefront that's arrived at our listener friend. Can that, from that graphical representation, can you determine where the source was? Well, you know it's on that axis because of the normal. But you also know, if you've got these gradient ears that can detect gradients, that that sound source must have been there. If we now change the curvature of that wavefront, can you pick where the sound source would be to generate that wavefront? Yep. It's on the same line because the normal's the same, but it's further out. So each source direction is determined by the perpendicular, and the distance can be replicated by just controlling the curvature of the wavefront. That doesn't mean humans can hear distance. It just means we can recreate the wavefronts so that the human can interpret the location of things. So the key difference to these new formats, as I call them, is that they take into account both distance and direction. Whereas, for 75 years, surround sound only considered direction. Now we come on to wavefront synthesis. What we need to do is to make loudspeakers that can recreate arbitrary curvatures of wavefronts. A little challenge for you over the semester break. Want to give it a go? Because if you can, then you've solved the problem of the sweet spot. Let's see how this can be done. Here we have a blue wavefront coming from a source located there. If you hear it here, you'll say, yes, that's where it is. I know the orthogonal component to that. I know where it is. I know where that is. Now, I want to create this new wavefront. It's still where this guy's going to hear it here, but now it's at a new location. And I want that to be consistent anywhere in that listening area, anywhere. The wavefront has to look like the red curve. If I can recreate that wavefront, that red wavefront, then it doesn't matter where you go, you will point at that sound source as being there. But notice the loudspeaker isn't there. We've got a problem. Okay. So what I do is I work out what additional vector wavefront I would have to generate at the origin to give me that net result. And the answer is the green. If I generate this omni sound field here and at the same time from this point here generate that directivity pattern, at every point those two will sum to be the new curve. Here you can see we've got a bit of gymnastics going on because the original curve needs to have some subtraction done to pull it back. Here, up here, we can see we need quite a bit of addition. But we now know that by constructing a loudspeaker that's an omnidirectional source and a loudspeaker that has this really weird directivity pattern, we can shift a sound source to a new location. That's what we want to do, isn't it? Okay. So that makes sense, I hope. There are going to be situations where that's not realisable. Silly things that slow you down, like needing infinite gain and infinite sound pressure level. Little handicaps. But generally that will work. You can make life easier for yourself by not shifting in arbitrary directions, but only shifting back along the centre line. If you do that, the demands that are made on your correction wave become less difficult. First off, you don't have this phase inversion problem. You only have to add or subtract. You don't have to, well, you only have to add a bit or a little bit more or a little bit less. You don't have to subtract. But all you're doing is pushing the sound forward or backward along that one axis. Does that mean you can hear the distance? Not necessarily. All it means is, if you walk around that now, you will swear that's where that sound source is. It isn't where the speaker is. Okay. So, we can now synthesise a wavefront with an arbitrary curvature. That's a really useful thing. The first way we can do that is just to do what we did in those examples. Have an omni and add to it this new and probably really expensive loudspeaker with controlled directivity and then fire them up with the same signal. Just a bit of caution about what has to happen at various frequencies. You've got to make sure that this behaves correctly for all frequencies. Bit of a challenge. However, it will work. The alternative is to use an array to create that controlled curvature. That doesn't mean that the speakers are now in the same location. It means they're spread out into a broadfire array or they're spread out into an endfire array. But we can create an array to provide controlled curvature. The two types are the endfire array, and when we set up an endfire array, we're going to have loudspeakers that work quite well off axis, because you're not going to be on axis all the time. You're going to walk around the room. If the endfire array is pointing there and you walk over there, you still want the same spectral energy density. So these are going to have to be new levels of controlled directivity speakers. The broadfire array is a different matter, but if you want that to work properly, you have to use the modified symmetric method of rendering. Otherwise, you get real problems with directivity and combing issues, which again, Paul knows all about. Okay. Or you can combine the two. You could have three loudspeakers in a triangle with a bit of directivity endfire and a bit of directivity broadfire. Okay, there are two sound systems available today that do this. They actually will reproduce sounds at a distance in a direction, and those sounds will stay where they are when you move around the room. These are systems that don't have a sweet spot. The first of these is the one that we did in 2001 called Vector Wavefront. And it basically uses endfire arrays to create controlled curvature. And that controlled curvature is correct in the whole of the listening area. So it does represent sources placed in space that stay fixed when you move. Each, in the photograph, you can see here's a far omni-source and here's a near omni-source forming the array and providing controlled curvature to render sound sources anywhere from in front of the nearest speaker off to the vanishing point or horizon well behind those speakers. Having two of those then enables you to place sound by stereoscopic means in any direction and at any distance. So you can create a 2D sound field going from as far back as you want, all the way to being in front of the screen, using four loudspeakers or two arrays. If you want to extend that to 3D, you'll need a third array minimum. Once you've done that, then you've got height, width, and depth for your sound object rendering. That's a bit more than you get with current 2D screens. It's also a bit more than you get with current stereoscopic television. And the reason it's more is stereoscopic television is a replicated image, whereas this changes as you move around and gives you variable perspective. To achieve this requires far more accurate omni-loudspeakers. These loudspeakers here, first generation, minus 6 dB at 80 degrees off axis at 22 kHz. Far better than you've had to date. The new loudspeakers, minus 4 dB at 90 degrees off axis at 22 kHz. Much better than you've had. But they never had to have accurate speakers. You always pointed them at the sweet spot. But now there's no sweet spot, they've got to be far better. Yes?
I just have a question. Off axis at the low frequencies, what is it? You talked about 22K.
As you go down in frequency, physics helps you and they become more omnidirectional. So they're omnidirectional from the low frequency cutoff of 100 Hz up to 22 kHz. The point I'm making is that if you're going to use the vector wavefront approach that we developed here in Australia, you're going to need far more accurate loudspeakers, special loudspeakers. The way this works is just basically by feeding, these are the two loudspeakers, by feeding the same signals but varying their phase, you can actually control the curvature of the wavefront being emitted.
Right.
Got a question?
Yeah, sorry. You mentioned N-fire
array. That's okay. N-fire just means that one loudspeaker is behind the other and you're looking at the end of the two. Broadfire means you can see both of them. They're equidistant from you.
So that picture on the previous slide, that was a combination?
It's an N-fire array that's been tilted up. So that's why I missed that. I should be reading my notes. That's actually 2.5D, because what happens here is, for instance, when you reproduce an orchestra, you're getting a perspective that's slightly down on the orchestra, so you get the sense that the instruments are spread back and higher. But it is, in fact, just 2D. I also should say that in order to reproduce the sound field that is 2D with placed objects, you need four channels, which means with current surround systems, you've got a spare 1.1 channels. Bit of a bunch. Okay, what's happening here is by controlling the amplitude and phase fed to these arrays, light goes crazy at the back, but in the direction of the listening area, you've got the ability to control the curvature from being tighter than would be the case with this loudspeaker location alone, all the way through to having a parallel wavefront, parallel listener area. And a parallel wavefront gives you the impression of an image at the vanishing point. The second approach was totally independently developed in Germany by the Fraunhofer Institute, famous for MP3 and other things, and spending money. The Fraunhofer approach was the symmetric example that I showed you before. First, to do your render using Broadfire, first, put a loudspeaker in the direction of every conceivable sound source. Every conceivable sound source. In a typical cinema, they use 230 loudspeakers around the listeners. Once you've done that, now that we know we've got a loudspeaker in the direction of any sound source, we can use symmetric render to give us the distance. And that's how the wave field synthesis of Fraunhofer works. Every loudspeaker... yes?
Would you like to say that there's sort of the inverse of the first scenario where you...
Yes, this is a subset of the other approach. Is that what you mean? This is a
surrounding
type,
the audience.
So that they can then use symmetric render, so they don't have these very demanding equalizations. The end fire means you need far, 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 far less loudspeakers and channels. But you do have demanding render, and you do need much better quality omnidirectional speakers.
And the audience can be basically on a surface.
Well, in both cases, the audience can be everywhere.
Well, in this case, the audience has to be within the circle.
Oh, yes, that's correct. They can be anywhere within.
That's right.
The Fraunhofer WFS demonstrations at the moment are all in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm sorry, I've been travelling trying to hear it. But I've got about 15 cinemas set up now throughout North America and Europe. And boy, are they expensive. Now, the problem with this is every loudspeaker needs its own independent amplifier. 230 loudspeakers, 230 amplifiers. And you need one extremely powerful rendering throughput engine that can handle 230 times 22 kilohertz bandwidth samples per second, which is a very demanding requirement for a rendering engine. But it works.
On both, or it's if you're going to have people near it, you need to have the same spacing, so you'll need more speakers. It's the resolving angle for that system. Okay. Fraunhofer basically creates the Huygens superposition of the multiple sources to control curvature, but in fact relies on picking the centre each time. Okay, so what I want you to go away with right now is this is not another evolution of surround. This is completely different. If you looked at it, you'd just say, oh, that's Fraunhofer guys, they're mad. They've gone to 230.2. It's not true. It's not true. It is different. And if you get, if I only achieve that tonight, I've achieved what I want to achieve, because you'll now know you've got to look at those two things in a different perspective. One of them has distance. One of them does not. Okay. These systems, or these formats, need a name. So go crazy, work out a name. At the moment, they tend to be called DD, for distance direction. So they're the DD formats. That's probably more true in the companion microphones, which are certainly referred to as DD microphones. But in the speakers, the same thing applies, it's distance direction. The benefits are you can now turn and move. There is no fixed forward perspective, but there are sound images placed in space. You can turn and you can move and you can sit where you want. And as you do that, your acoustic viewing perspective changes. So you'll be able to go and sit in your favourite instrument, as the Americans said. Or sit on your favourite instrument. Sit with your favourite instrument. The other side of this is, if we can place sounds away from the loudspeakers creating them, we can do the reverse. We can take the speakers and move them out of the road and still put the sound back where we wanted it. This is 3D vision ready, but not quite, because as you move in the listening area, as I said before, your perspective of the acoustics will change. You'll have viewing perspectives that change as you move. But current stereoscopic vision doesn't do that. It's a replicated, wherever you go, it's the same relative render. And finally, this is all totally forward and backward stereo and surround compatible, because all you do is say, I'm going to render all my sound sources to the fixed distance of my speaker diameter. And then it's just a surround system. Why you would do that, I do not know, but you could do it. Another way of doing it is, if you're using what I described as the vector wave front end-fire system, place the end-fire arrays where you would have put your surround speakers, because then all you have to do is turn off the array and just use one speaker. And it is a very high-quality surround sound system. Okay, finally, nearly finally, what does this mean for production? What does this mean for the end-to-end chain from capture through edit, distribution, archiving, render, reproduction? What does it mean? Well, the two systems have different impacts, mainly because the Fraunhofer wave field synthesis has to be hand-rendered. They don't have a capture technology to capture distance and direction. Therefore, wave field synthesis gets a tick in the render and reproduction end, but starts to miss out with the capture, edit and distribution. It would be feasible to put in 230 full bandwidth distribution channels, perhaps. But I don't think so. So really, the Wayfield synthesis reproduction does not have a distribution capability. Because of the limited number of channels, vector wavefront does. But the downside is you need better loudspeakers. So vector wavefront has the dual of the loudspeakers for capture microphones, arrays. It has an electronic vector format for distributing the channels. And it has new render decoders, but it has these new speaker formats. The actual format of distribution for existing surround systems can use perceptual coding. By perceptual coding, I mean they can throw away bits of data to reduce bandwidth, because when a loud sound comes along, you can't hear those details behind it. So that's been an advantage. With these systems, we are now effectively divorcing the channel from the render. So now the compression algorithms for MP3 and other aspects of lossy perceptual coding, who knows what I mean by lossy perceptual? They throw stuff away, mate. Those systems will need reworking, because you can't be sure where that listener is going to be listening. They may go around next to the cymbals, and you just run away the cymbals because the bass drum over there went from. So now we need to revisit the perceptual coding approaches on the channels. There are some interesting twists in all this.
Brian,
yes.
I know you said the microphone receptacle socket on can't sit in there and switch
Yeah. Well, I can talk to you about that, but can we do it after the show? I really want to get this through. If I make one point tonight, it'll be that this is new. Okay. The other thing that I do point out is that the vector wavefront end-to-end facilities are the perfect match for the Wayfield synthesis guys, because they provide the capture, edit, store, distribute, and then plug straight into their end capability. And at the moment, we have been discussing a cooperation with Fraunhofer with that end. So hopefully, please all cross your fingers. Dealing with the Germans is a challenge, but that could be really good. Could be really good. Okay. There are industry issues here. Capture. We need new microphones for DD. Some present-day microphones and arrays, which I'm talking about, are okay. It's just the configurations are more different. So you're putting up not a Decatrudy or a LRP or whatever, you're putting up a new format. And we've actually done recordings using standard Sherps and Neumanns and whatever. And that works okay.
Is the Calrex outfield? Does it sound like
yes,
the
yes. Calrex outfield is a great thing to use. Move the mass. Have I been talking too much again? All right, now I'm going to read this out to you, and you're going to all fall asleep. There is capture. In capture, we need new microphones that do capture and preserve distance and direction information. That sounds all fancy, but really what it means is capture wavefront intensity and divergence occurs. That's all it means. We're going to need new production facilities. We're going to have to place sounds at a distance in a direction. We have to preserve sounds at a distance in direction. We're going to have to bring in feeds that are correctly positioned in a sound field. But these are really just extensions of what we've had now. So you'll have to get your plugins for your Pro Tools or something. Distribution. I talked about the audio coders and decoders and the fact that there'll be some software work for a whole lot of people, and a whole lot of PhDs for that. AC3, MP3, AAC, Dolby Digital, all those systems will need a bit of a tweak because they are all lossy coders. I'm a bit anti-lossy coder. Do you get that impression? Yes, you can. I was going to mention Blu-ray has at least two multi-channel formats that are lossless. What I'm saying is, wouldn't it be a good idea to look at those perceptual coders and apply it to place, distance, direction, audio? Because there'll be some PhDs there in new methods of compression with transparency. New algorithms are required. Reproduction, you've got the choice. You either have a few much higher quality speakers or you have speakers everywhere. If I was a speaker manufacturer, I'd love you to buy 230 loudspeakers. But I don't think it'll go that way.
Well, one loudspeaker costs 230 times as much.
Well, four. Each of 25 times. I like you. Can I be your card? So you've got those choices. But the big issues to me are standards. Do we want to repeat what happened in the cinema industry for 40 years where there weren't standards? And so everybody just did their own thing and came up with their own format. Or do we want to start specifying what the standards for DD, capture and reproduction, will be? Me, I would think it would be a very good idea to get some standards in place. I go to the meetings and talk to them. They have no idea. That's an important thing to me. It'd be nice because I've captured the market, but I would like to think that this has a persistence into the future rather than saying, well, we captured it like the recipe for Kentucky Fried Chicken, 11 herbs and spices, but nobody can copy it. So that's education and training. Capture, distribution, render, archive, reproduce, encode, decode, distribute, reproduce. There's going to be a whole lot of new stuff required for training and education. Installed base compatibility. What about all the stuff we've got floating around now? Do we all just say it's rendered at the distance of the old speakers? It's all going to be a 2 metre render. Or do we want to actually pull out some of the distance information as we can, with, for instance, Calric, and then reproduce it consistently with what happened in the original recording? There's a lot of material out there. I mean, the good thing is these systems are both compatible with all of that material. Then there's another area. Oh, yes, Mark.
There's
technologies around now that help you take stereo recording and convert that to high quality.
Yes. Do you see
the developments around? I certainly do, and in fact, we do that. Auto render, you can pull some information out of existing recordings and then render it accordingly, put it in your own proprietary format. Yes, that is very true. That will come to pass.
Yes. You know it's actually new.
How do you know?
Yeah.
Good question. You don't necessarily know it's in there until you try and decode, put it through a rendering machine, and see if you do get differentiation of placed sounds. But if the original recording was done with very simple microphone placements and arrays, it's going to be a challenge.
You can actually see some of that with the vectorscope.
Yes, you would be able to see a differentiation. Yeah.
My past thing is that I think of the stereo music, I like music, I think the stereo music is sort of well done.
actually existing very cool.
Not necessarily.
If you recall, this is my device, and you remember an endless ice machine, that's fine. But if, how much music a lot of people listen to people do with this? It's a very, very small amount of music, right? I like Michael Jackson. You can't tell when you.
First of all, you have to get out of rock and pop. You've got to look at jazz, classical music.
Yes. What I will say is two things. First one is, if you take some of the Calrec recordings, they do contain, you can extract a lot of information because they record the whole sound. They're not as high resolution as the new microphones in terms of separation, but there is an awful lot of information. And you can almost, once you've seen or heard that, you can almost pick it, because you'll hear a natural ambience in the recording. I think you may understand that. If you hear an ambience that is of a natural acoustic environment, that's a good indicator that you'll probably get some distance and direction information out of that recording.
If I can make a comment on that. I've got a recording by Peter Skellen in London that uses a jazz group as a background. And he plays piano, of course, but he also plays a lot of things, and he plays vocal overdubs. You can very clearly hear the spacing and position of the individual jazz instruments in the backing room, and then you can hear the others rising up with rendering. It's a brilliant recording. You can also display that on the cathode oscilloscope and actually pick the positions of the instruments.
Was that
that's what the product said. You have to be in the sweet spot to get the ratio at all.
Does that sound
like a no, it's full on there.
What also you'll hear a very flat place render in amongst something that has distance and direction render. It's almost like a cartoon. It's just flat.
But if you also want to hear some very well done modern line stuff, listen to some of the Beatles work. The later Beatles stuff was very, very interesting.
But presumably if he was echoing it, it was something like heavily edited light wing stuff, then if you put it through any kind of decoding thing, if you're assuming that there's some picture right there, it's going to connect back.
No.
George Martin was actually pretty clever, and he came up through the MS door, which is basically all mine. So he got fairly close to replicating it.
Yeah.
He put some of that later Beatles stuff and Sergeant Pepper's on with not the stuff that I expected on the problem, if you look at that compared with, say, the Peter Skellen people, there's a great similarity between the two, and one is obviously modern track, and the other one was done with a classical microphone.
What we need to do is to give them the tools of distance and direction.
Indeed.
So that they can then
really make it work.
Yes.
And see the difference.
There are other opportunities. I'll only briefly mention these. They're outside of the audio acoustics domain in the main, but one of them isn't. If we're able to capture the distance and direction of a sound source and able to reproduce a sound source at a distance in a direction, then couldn't we actually reproduce an anti-sound source at the location of that original source? And if we did that, wouldn't we then have broadband wide area noise cancellation, holy grail? That's a very interesting application. The other ones are audio forensics, pulling material out of captured sound fields, surveillance, and that is shaping up to be the killer app because of contract work. Now we can resolve distance as well as direction. And then, what about sonar? This is all waves. What about ultrasonics? This is all waves. What about seismology? This is all waves.
Right, are you familiar with LRAP?
Yes.
I mean, a range of physical devices. It's a military application of ultrasonics where they can direct a.
Oh, it's just I've got those machines.
Yeah, and then they can almost position the sound right next to you. And
They can, and that's weaponry.
Well, there's also applications of it.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's a similar type of device, isn't it? Except
they're using ultrasonics
to actually generate.
Yeah, their pencil beam at those frequencies, directivity, from a larger rating, get very, very precise directivity. That is directivity angle, it is not distance discrimination. I suppose if you said there's one here and one here, we'll make it so they add, and that could work. But it's a valid point. Yeah. I implore you to go through the literature, please, and report back if you will, because this whole concept of distance and direction is missing. Even in sonar, where you need these concepts.
Yeah, there's a research facility here in Melbourne for industrial ultrasonic measure by ultra.
There's the work that was being done by RMIT.
This is a private company producing ultrasonic transducers for a global market here in Melbourne.
Okay.
Most of the industrial ultrasonic transducers are used around the world.
Okay, I'll get some details from you. It's good. I've got to find
out. They do a lot of research on ultrasonics and acoustics. And
good. Where are they based?
One of the eastern suburbs.
Oh, the leafy eastern. Okay, well, I'd love if you get some information. Ultra Hawk, is it?
I think it's
Ultra
Hawk.
Okay.
Maybe just Hawk measurement.
Hawk measurement system. Okay. Thank you. That's good. So.
So there was another. You guys are all aficionados, and you're talking about, you know, rendering or replicating sort of acoustic environments for music, but. Surely there are more commercial applications for this in terms of, you know, PC gaming and
yes, there are. Yeah, yeah.
Home theater and even the theater systems.
Yes, that is true. The technology, even though it was 2001 that we did the first theory and then the crude demonstration systems 2002, it's early days. If you look at the history of these various formats, they do take 20 years to sort of.
I haven't been to one of these three-dimensional films yet, but I hear they're very popular. You go to the cinema and watch a 3D film, and I would imagine that if the audio was three-dimensional as well, it would
It adds a new input. Yes, you can talk to those that have listened to it. Okay, so there are some applications beyond the audio and acoustics, but I would like the audio and acoustics to be a leader, so I inspire you all to help me. Okay, so I'm at the conclusions now. The conclusions are that DD,
distance, direction, yeah. Put distance first, please,
is a new and alternative to surround sound. It has emerged. It is fully compatible, surround sound. And stereo. It probably answers some of the points you were making about the perceptual distance information contained in quality recordings. And we'll take them further.
I personally believe that the quality recording market doesn't exist.
It's been decimated.
It hasn't been decimated, it's been hijacked by journalists.
Yeah, okay.
And really, we can name the recordings that people say are really good.
I do. I understand fully. If this was taken on, it may be a chance to redress that. You can have decoders that enable you to place your audio imagery as you desire, and that could be a premium service. And then everybody else can get the MP3 equivalent of this, which will just be a flat render. And then the really baseline system, the commodity system, will just be a surround system. But you need to be able to differentiate that so you can get what you want. And at the moment, I have to agree with you, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, I'm not against high quality sound. To me, the way that I see it is that it's lot of people who deal with don't really care. Like, when they go and see a movie like that, sort of that way, something like that.
Yeah.
Shrek or Titanic. There's no one who cares to them. They get blown away by what was presented. So it's
oh, yes,
essence, yeah. it's a sensation. It's a brilliant sensation that they actually try to come up through advertising. That's true. So they try to
yeah.
So they've got good sound production values and stuff like that.
No, but no, and why would anybody advertise a witness?
No, I'm saying to you something else. What I'm saying to you is, if you have a movie, current movie, and you apply your technology to it, what would anybody go to see? That's a problem.
The cinema issue is a problem until the technology to render visual objects in space appears, then it will be necessary. At the moment, the what is called 3D, 2.5D, doesn't have that. It's not placing objects in space so you can get variable perspectives of those objects. When that comes, yes, this will be necessary, but at the moment we're not there. So I think I'm
clear. I think we're talking about the difference between black and white color television.
Probably, yes.
Probably.
I'm going to shut it down because you've probably had enough of me talking. No sweet spot restriction. History shows that these technologies take time to be adopted. I don't want that to mean that we just don't do anything. We've got a whole lot of work to do. This is going to get legitimised in standards work, it's going to get legitimised in education. Even if you're not going to implement that system, you can certainly build better speakers and microphones by using those principles. I don't want to see it buried. So we really probably do need to start now as the AES chapter of Melbourne to move this somehow into a legitimate channel, as well as what the Europeans are doing. And it has wider application than just a format. But tonight I wanted you to understand that it was different. It was not just another surround system, and I hope I've achieved that. Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.